Side 5, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings, continuing on page 152.
Those gates wouldn't keep out a herd of sheep, and even counting the church soldiers, we don't have enough men to hold off the kind of force gathering out there.
You're raising a very unpleasant notion, Comier, Darylon said.
I know, but I don't see very many options, do you?
Not really.
I'm sorry, my lords, Sir Noshan said deferentially, but I don't quite follow what you've got in mind.
We'll have to pull back to the walls of the inner city, Noshan, Vanion told him.
And abandon the rest? Noshan exclaimed. My lords, we're talking about the largest and richest city in the world.
We have no choice, Sir Noshan, Abriel explained. The walls of the inner city were built in antiquity. They're much higher and stronger than the largely ornamental walls that encircle the rest of Kyrelos. We can defend the inner city for a time at least, but we have no chance of holding the whole city.
We're going to have to make some hard and unpleasant choices here, Preceptor Darylon said. If we pull back to the inner walls, we're going to have to close the gates to the general population. We won't have sufficient supplies in the old city to sustain that many people.
We won't be able to do a thing until we can take command of the church soldiers, though, Vanion said. 400 of us couldn't possibly hold out against Martell's army.
I might be able to help you there, Patriarch Emban said.
Emban was sprawled in a large chair, his fat hands on his paunch.
It's going to depend on just how arrogant Makova's feeling in the morning, however.
Emban had been evasive when Sparhawk had demanded some sort of explanation about what he had sent Kurik and Beirut to do.
We're going to have a certain tactical advantage, Comier said thoughtfully. Martell's troops are mercenaries. As soon as they get inside the outer city, they're going to stop for some constructive looting. That's going to give us more time.
Emban chuckled.
It's also going to distract a sizable portion of the hierocracy.
He grinned.
Many of my fellow patriarchs have lavish houses out beyond the inner walls. They'll view the sacking of the outer city with a certain anguish, I'd imagine. That might just reduce their enthusiasm for the candidacy of the Primate of Cimera. My house, however, is here inside the old walls. I'll be able to think quite clearly. And so will you, won't you, Dolmant?
You're a bad man, Emban, Dolmant told him.
But God appreciates my efforts, Dolmant, no matter how sneaky or underhanded. All of us live but to serve, each in his own special way.
He paused, frowning slightly.
Ortsal's our candidate. I'd have probably chosen someone else, but there's a tide of conservatism in the church just now, and Ortsal's so conservative that he doesn't even believe in fire. We may have to work on him just a bit, Dolmant. He's not exactly what you'd call lovable.
That's our problem, Emban, yours and mine, Dolmant pointed out. I think we should concern ourselves with military matters at the moment.
I suspect that our next step will have to be charting out routes for withdrawal, Abriel said. If the Patriarch of Usera here is successful in transferring command of the church soldiers over to us, we'll have to move them back inside the inner walls rapidly before the general population realizes what we're doing. Otherwise, we'll have mobs of refugees in here with us.
This is brutal, my lords, Sophronia chided them. You're abandoning innocent people to the mercy of a horde of savages. Martell's men won't be satisfied with just looting. There are certain to be atrocities out there.
Dolmant sighed.
War is never civilized, little mother, he told her.
One other thing. From now on, you will accompany us to the Basilica every day. I want you where we can protect you.
As you wish, dear one, she replied.
Talon's face was mournful.
I don't suppose you could see your way clear to sort of let me slip outside the inner walls before you close the gates, could you?
He asked Sparhawk.
No, Sparhawk replied. But why would you want to be out there?
To look after my share of the loot, naturally. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
You would surely not join in the looting of houses, would you, Talon?
Xavier asked in a shocked tone.
Of course not, Xavier. I'd let Martell's soldiers do that. It's when they're back out in the street with their arms full of the things that they've stolen that the thieves of Kyrelos will move in and pick them over. Martell's going to lose a lot of men in the next few days, I'd imagine. I can almost guarantee that an epidemic of stab wounds is going to break out in his ranks before this is all over. There are beggars out there who'll never have to beg again.
The boy sighed again.
You're robbing my childhood of all its fun, Sparhawk, he accused.
There is absolutely no danger whatsoever, my brothers, Markova scoffed the following morning when the Hierocracy reconvened. The commander of my own personal guard, Captain Gorta...
He paused a moment to give the preceptors of the militant orders a hard stare.
The sudden demise of the previous captain of his troops obviously still rankled. Captain Erden, that is, went out at great personal risk to question these approaching pilgrims most closely, and he assures me that they are no more than that, pilgrims, faithful sons of the Church, and that they are making this pilgrimage to the Holy City in order to join their voices with others in thanksgiving when the new archprelate is elevated to the Holy Throne.
Now that's really amazing, Markova, Patriarch Emban drawled. As it so happens, I sent observers of my own out of the city, and they had an entirely different kind of report. How do you imagine we can reconcile these differences?
Markova's smile was brief, even frosty.
The Patriarch of Usera is well known for his jocularity, he said. He is indeed a droll and jolly fellow, and his merry japes frequently relax our tensions at stressful moments, but is this really the time for hilarity, my dear Emban?
Do you see me smiling, Markova?
Emban's tone had quite nearly the bite of a dagger thrust to the kidneys. He rose, grunting.
What my people report, dear brothers, is that this horde of so-called pilgrims at our gates is anything but friendly.
Nonsense, Markova snapped.
Perhaps, Emban said. But I've taken the liberty of having one of these pilgrims brought here to the Basilica so that we may examine him more closely. He may not choose to speak very much, but much can be gleaned from observing a man's demeanor, his bearing, his origins, even his clothing.
Emban clapped his hands sharply together before Markova could object or exert his authority. The door to the chamber opened, and Kurik and Beirut entered. They each held an ankle of the black-robed man they were bringing in to be interviewed, and they dragged the inert body across the marble floor, leaving a long crimson smear of blood on the white stone behind them.
"What are you doing?" Markova half-shrieked.
"Merely presenting evidence, Markova. No rational decision can be made without a thorough examination of the evidence, can it?" Emban pointed at a spot not too far in front of the lectern.
"Put the witness there, my friends," he instructed Kurik and Beirut.
"I forbid this," Markova howled.
"Forbid away, old boy," Emban shrugged. "But it's too late now. Everybody in the chamber has already seen this man, and we all know what he is, don't we?"
Emban waddled over to the corpse lying spread-eagled on the marble floor.
"We can all tell by this man's features what his nation of origin was, and his black clothing confirms it. My brothers, what we have here was obviously a Rendor."
"Patriarch Emban of Usera," Markova said desperately, "I arrest you on the charge of murder."
"Don't be an ass, Markova," Emban said. "You can't arrest me while the Hierocracy's in session. Besides, we're inside the Basilica, and I claim sanctuary."
He looked at Kurik.
"Did you really have to kill him?" he asked.
"Yes, Your Grace," the burly squire replied. "The situation made it necessary. But we said a brief prayer over him afterward, though."
"Most exemplary, my son," Emban said. "I will therefore grant you and your young companion here full absolution for your part in sending this miserable heretic to face the infinite mercy of God."
The fat man looked around the chamber.
"Now," he said, "to return to our interrogation of this pilgrim. We have here a Rendor, armed with a sword, you'll note. Since the only Rendors currently on this part of the Eosian continent are Ashandists, we must conclude that this pilgrim was one as well. Given their views, would we expect Ashandist heretics to come to the Holy City to celebrate the elevation of a new archprelate? Has our dear brother Markova somehow miraculously converted the heretics of the south to the worship of the true God, and rejoined them with the body of our Holy Mother Church? I pause for the reply of the esteemed Patriarch of Qum."
He stood looking expectantly at Markova. I'm certainly glad he's on our side, Euleth murmured to Tinian.
Truly.
Ah, Emban said as Markova looked at him helplessly. It was too much to hope for, I suppose. We must all apologize to God for our failure to seize this opportunity to heal the wound in the body of our Holy Mother. Our regret, however, and our bitter tears of disappointment must not dim our eyes to the harshness of reality. The pilgrims at our gates are not what they seem. Our dear brother Markova has been cruelly deceived, I'm afraid. What stands at the gates of Kyrillos is not a multitude of the faithful, but a ravening army of our most hated foes, bent on destroying and desecrating the very center of the true faith. Our own personal fate, my brothers, is of no moment, but I should advise you all to make your peace with God. The horrors the Ashandist heretics inflict upon members of the higher clergy are too well known to require repeating. I myself am totally resigned to facing the flames. He paused, then grinned. He clapped both hands to his huge paunch. I'll make a jolly fire, though. A titter of nervous laughter rippled through the chamber. Our own fates, my brothers, are not important, Emban continued. What matters here is the fate of the Holy City and the fate of the Church. We face a cruel but simple decision. Do we surrender our mother to the heretics, or do we fight? Fight! One patriarch shouted, springing to his feet. Fight! The cry was quickly taken up. Soon the entire hierocracy was on its feet, roaring out the word, fight. Emban clasped his hands behind his back, somewhat theatrically, and bowed his head. When he lifted his face, tears were actually streaming down his cheeks. He turned slowly, giving everyone in the audience chamber ample opportunity to see those tears. Alas, my brothers, he said in a broken voice. Our vows forbid us to lay aside our cassocks and vestments and to take up the sword. We stand helpless in this dreadful crisis. We are doomed, my brothers, and our Holy Mother Church is doomed with us. Alas that I have lived so long that I must witness this terrible day. Where can we turn, brothers? Who will come to our aid? Who has the power to protect us in this darkest hour? What manner of men are there in all the world who can defend us in this dreadful, fatal conflict? There was a breathless pause. The Church Knights! A feeble old voice wheezed from one of the red-cushioned benches. We must turn to the Knights of the Church! Not even the powers of hell can prevail against them! The Church Knights! The hierocracy roared as in one voice. The Church Knights! Chapter 11. The excited tumult in the large chamber continued for some time as Patriarch Emban of Euserra stood gravely in the center of the long marble floor, just happening to have placed himself in the precise center of that elongated circle of light streaming down through the round window behind the vacant throne. As the babble of voices began to die out, Emban raised one pudgy hand. Indeed, my brothers, he continued, his voice carrying just that right note of gravity. The invincible knights of the Church could easily defend Kyrillos. But the knights are committed at this time to the defense of Arsham. The preceptors are here, of course, taking their rightful places among us. But each of them has but a token force here, certainly not enough to fight off the armies of darkness encircling us. We cannot whisk the full might of the militant orders from the rocky plains of Arsham to the holy city in the twinkling of an eye. And even if we could, how could we convince the commanders of the army in that sorely beset kingdom that our need is greater than theirs, and thus persuade them to release the knights to come to our aid? Patriarch Orzel of Kadok rose to his feet, his severe face framed by his pale graying hair. If I may speak, Emban, he said. The Patriarch of Kadok was the compromise candidate of the factions opposed to Aeneas, and he spoke with a certain authority. Of course, Emban said. I eagerly await the wisdom of my esteemed brother from Lamarkand. The paramount duty of the Church is to survive, so that she may continue her work, Orzel said in his harsh voice. All other considerations must be secondary to that. Will we all concede that point? There was a murmur of agreement.
There are times when sacrifices must be made, Ortsel continued. If a man's leg be caught between the rocks at the bottom of a tidal pool and the rising waters be lapping at his chin, must not the man regretfully sacrifice the limb in order to save his life? Thus it is with us. In sorrow must we sacrifice the whole of Arsham, if need be, to save our life, which is our Holy Mother Church. What we are faced with here, my brothers, is a crisis. In times past, the hierocracy has been extremely reluctant to impose the stern and stringent requirements of this most extreme of measures. But the situation facing us is doubtless the severest trial facing our Holy Mother since the Zamok invasion 5 centuries ago. God is watching us, my brothers, and will surely judge us and our fitness to continue our stewardship of his beloved church. I therefore, as the laws that govern us require, demand that an immediate vote be taken. The question upon which we will vote can be stated most simply. Does the current situation in Kyrillos constitute a crisis of the faith? Yes or no? Markova's eyes were wide with shock. Surely, he burst out, surely the situation is not that critical. We have not even tried negotiation with the armies at our gates as yet, and... The Patriarch is not in order, Ortsel said abruptly. The question of crisis of the faith is not open to discussion. Point of law, Markova shouted. Ortsel looked intimidatingly at the weedy monk who served as law clerk. Speak the law, he commanded. The monk was trembling violently, and he began to pore desperately through his books.
What's happening here? Callan asked in confusion. I don't understand.
Crisis of the faith is almost never invoked, Xavier told him, probably because the kings of Western Aeosia object so violently. In a crisis of the faith, the church assumes control of everything. Governments, armies, resources, money, everything.
But wouldn't a crisis of the faith require a substantive vote? Calton asked. Or even unanimity?
I don't think so, Xavier said. Let's see what the law clerk has to say.
Isn't it sort of redundant at this point, anyway? Tinian asked. We've already sent for Worgen and told him that there's a church crisis.
Somebody probably neglected to tell Ortsel, Euleth replied. He's a stickler for legalities, and there's no real point in disturbing his sensibilities, is there?
The weedy monk, his face absolutely white, rose and cleared his throat. His voice was squeaky with fright as he began.
The Patriarch of Kadik has correctly cited the law, he declared. The question of crisis of the faith must be put to an immediate secret vote.
Secret? Markova exclaimed.
Such is the law, Your Grace, and the vote is to be decided by a simple majority.
But
I must remind the Patriarch of Kum that further discussion is not in order. Ortsel's voice cracked like a whip.
I call for the vote.
He looked around.
You!
He snapped at the clergyman sitting not far from the goggle-eyed Aeneas. Fetch the instruments of the vote. They are, as I recall, in the chest at the right hand of the archprelate's throne. The clergyman hesitated, looking fearfully at Aeneas.
Move, men! Ortsel roared.
The priest jumped to his feet and ran to the shrouded throne.
Somebody's going to have to explain this to me a little better, Talon said in a baffled voice.
Later, Talon. Sophronia told him softly.
Sophronia, wearing a heavy black robe that looked slightly ecclesiastical and concealed her race and sex, sat among the church knights, almost totally concealed by their armored bulk.
Let's watch the exquisite dance being performed before us.
Sophronia, Sparhawk chided her.
Sorry, she apologized. I'm not poking fun at your church, Sparhawk, just at all this involuted maneuvering.
The instruments of the vote consisted of a fairly large black box, quite dusty and totally unadorned, and 2 plain leather bags, securely held shut with stamped leaden seals.
Patriarch of Kum, Ortsel said quite concisely, you hold the chair at the moment. It is your duty to break the seals and cause the ballots to be distributed.
Markova glanced quickly at the law clerk, and the little monk nodded. Then Markova took up the 2 bags, pried open the leaden seals, and took an object from each. They were perhaps the size of a common penny. One was white, and the other black.
We will vote with these, he declared to his fellow patriarchs, holding the counters up. Is it agreed that the black means no, and the white yes?
There was a rumble of agreement.
"Distribute the counters, then," Markova instructed a pair of youthful pages. "Each member of the hierocracy shall receive one white counter and one black."
He cleared his throat.
"As God gives you wisdom, my brothers, vote your consciences in this matter."
Some trace of color had returned to Makova's face.
"He's been counting votes," Calton said.
"He's got 59, and he thinks we've only got 47. He doesn't know about the five patriarchs hiding in that closet. I'd imagine those five votes will come as quite a surprise to him. He'll still win, though."
"You're forgetting the neutrals, Calton," Xavier reminded him.
"They'll just abstain, won't they? They're still looking for bribes. They're not going to offend either side."
"They can't abstain, Calton," Xavier told him. "Not on this vote. Church law says that they have to come down on one side or the other of this question."
"Where did you learn so much about this, Xavier? I told you that I'd studied military history."
"What's military history got to do with this?"
"The church declared a crisis of the faith during the Zamok invasion. I look into it as part of my study."
"Oh."
As the two pages were distributing the counters, Dolmant rose and walked to the huge doors. He spoke briefly to the members of the Archprelate's guard standing outside and returned to his seat. It was when the two boys distributing the counters were nearly at the end of the fourth row of the crimson cushioned benches that the door opened and the five nervous patriarchs who had been in hiding filed in.
"What's the meaning of this?"
Makova was goggle-eyed.
"The Patriarch of Kum is not in order," Ortsel reminded him.
Ortsel seemed to enjoy saying that to Makova.
"My brothers," he began to address the five, "we are presently voting on..." "It is my responsibility to instruct our brothers," Makova said vehemently. "The Patriarch of Kum is in error," Ortsel said in a clipped voice. "It was I who put the question before the hierocracy, and therefore the responsibility is mine."
He quickly explained the vote to his five fellow patriarchs.
He stressed the gravity of the situation to them, something Makova surely would not have done.
Makova regained his composure.
"He's counting votes again," Calton murmured. "He's still got more than we have. It all hangs on the neutrals now."
The black box was placed on a table in front of Makova's lectern, and the patriarchs filed by, each depositing one of his counters in the slot on the top of the box. Some were quite obvious about which counter they were depositing. Others were not.
"I'll take care of the tallying," Makova declared.
"No," Ortsel said flatly.
"At least not alone. It was I who placed the question before the hierocracy, and I will assist you."
"I'm beginning to like Ortsel more and more," Tinian said to Euleth.
"Yes," Euleth agreed. "Maybe we misjudged him."
Makova's face grew more gray as he and Ortsel began to tally up the votes. There was a hushed, almost breathless silence as the tallying continued.
"And done," Ortsel said curtly. "Announce the totals, Makova."
Makova threw a quick, apologetic glance at Annius.
"The vote stands at 64 yes and 56 no," he muttered almost inaudibly.
"Say it again, Makova," Ortsel prompted. "Some of our brothers have failing hearing."
Makova gave him a look filled with hatred, and repeated the totals in a louder voice.
"We got the neutrals,"
Talon exulted.
"And we stole three of Annius' votes as well."
"Well then," Emben said mildly, "I'm glad that's been settled. We have much to consider, my brothers, and very little time. Am I correct in assuming that it is the will of the hierocracy that we send immediately for the Church Knights, and the armies of Western Aeosia as well, to come to our defense with all possible haste? Will you leave the kingdom of Arsham totally defenseless, Emben?" Makova demanded.
"Just what's threatening Arsham at the moment, Makova? All the Ashandists are camped outside our gates.
Do you want another vote?"
"Substance,"
Makova said flatly, insisting on a 60% majority on the question.
"Point of law,"
Emben replied. His fat face had an almost saintly expression. He looked at the law clerk.
"What is the law on matters of substance under these circumstances?" he asked.
"Saving only the election of an archprelate, a substantive vote is not required in times of crisis of the faith, your grace," the monk replied.
"I rather thought that might be the case." Emben smiled.
"Well, Makova, do we vote or not?" I'll withdraw the question of substance, Makova conceded grudgingly. But exactly how do you propose to get a messenger out of a besieged city?
Ortsel rose again. As my brothers may be aware, I am a Lamarck, he said. We are well accustomed to sieges in Lamarkand. Last night I sent 20 of my own men in disguise to the outskirts of the city and beyond. They are awaiting only that signal that even now rises as a plume of red smoke from the dome of this very basilica. I would surmise that they are already riding hard for Arsham. At least they'd better be if they know what's good for them.
I'm going to like him, Qualton grinned.
You dare do this without the consent of the hierocracy as a whole, Ortsel?
Makova gasped.
Was there ever any doubt concerning the outcome of the voting, Makova?
I begin to catch a strong smell of collusion here, Sophronia said lightly.
My brothers, Imban continued, the crisis we presently face is clearly a military one, and for the most part we are not military men. How may we avoid the errors, the confusion, the delays that untrained and unworldly churchmen must inevitably cause as they flounder through unfamiliar complexities? The leadership of the Patriarch of Coombe has been exemplary, and I'm sure we join together in expressing our heartfelt gratitude to him. But regrettably, the Patriarch of Coombe is no more well-versed in military science than I. And I'll confess it freely, my brothers, I can't tell one end of a sword from the other. He smiled broadly. Quite obviously, my training has been with eating implements rather than with those of war. I'd be happy to accept any challenge in that area, however. My opponent and I could happily duel to the death on a well-roasted ox.
The hierocracy laughed at that. The tension was somewhat relaxed by the laughter.
We need a military man, my brothers, Imban continued. We need a general now instead of a chairman. We have 4 such generals in our very midst. These, of course, are the preceptors of the 4 orders.
There was an excited stir, but Imban held up one hand.
But, he continued, do we dare distract one of these towering military geniuses from the vital task of defending Kyrillos? I think not. Where then should we look?
He paused.
I must now break a solemn promise I made to one of my brothers, he confessed. I pray that both he and God will be able to find it in their hearts to forgive me. We do in fact have a man with military training in our midst, dear brothers. He had modestly concealed this fact, but a modesty that deprives us of his talent in this time of crisis is no virtue.
His broad, round face took on an expression of genuine regret.
Forgive me, Dolmant, he said, but I have no choice in this matter. My duty to the church comes even before my duty to a friend.
Dolmant's eyes were frosty.
Imban sighed. I expect that when we conclude this meeting, my dear brother from Deimos will thrash me thoroughly. But I'm well padded, and the bruises won't be all that visible, I hope. In his youth, the Patriarch of Deimos was an acolyte in the Pandion Order, and there was a sudden amazed babble in the chamber.
Imban raised his voice.
Preceptor Vanion of that order, who was himself a novice at the selfsame time, assures me that our saintly brother from Deimos was a consummate warrior, and might very well have risen to the rank of preceptor himself, had not our holy mother found other uses for his vast talents.
He paused again.
Praise God, my brothers, that we were never faced with that decision. Choosing between Vanion and Dolmant would likely have been a task beyond our combined wisdom.
He continued for a time, heaping praise upon Dolmant. Then he looked around.
What is our decision, my brothers? Shall we beseech our brother of Deimos to guide us in this time of our gravest peril?
Makova stared at him. His mouth opened a couple of times as if he were on the verge of speaking, but each time he clamped it tightly shut. Sparhawk put his hands on the bench in front of him, leaned forward, and spoke quietly to the elderly monk sitting in front of him.
Has Patriarch Makova been suddenly struck dumb, neighbor? He asked. I'd have thought he'd be climbing the walls by now.
In a very real sense, the Patriarch of Coombe has been struck dumb, Sir Knight, the monk replied. There's a long-standing custom, even a rule, in the hierocracy,
that a patriarch may not speak to his own candidacy for any post, no matter how remote that candidacy may be. It's considered immodest.
Sensible custom, that one, Sparhawk said.
I feel much the same way, Sir Knight, the monk smiled.
Markova tends to put me to sleep for some reason.
Sparhawk grinned at him.
Me too, he said. I suppose we should both pray for greater patience. One of these days.
Markova looked around desperately, but none of his friends saw fit to speak, either because of a lack of anything flattering to say about him or because they could see which way a vote would go.
Vote, he said somewhat sullenly.
Good idea, Markova, Emben smiled. Let's move right along. Time's fleeing even as we speak.
The vote this time was 65 for Dolmance assuming the chair and 55 against. Another of the supporters of the Primate of Simera had defected.
My brother from Deimos, Emben said to Dolmant when the tally had been completed and announced. Would you be so kind as to assume the chair?
Dolmant came forward while Markova angrily gathered up his papers and stalked away from the lectern.
You honor me beyond my ability to express my gratitude, my brothers, Dolmant said. For the moment, let me merely say thank you so that we may more quickly deal with the crisis at hand. Our most immediate need is for a greater force under the command of the Knights of the Church. How may we address that need?
Emben had not even bothered to sit down.
The force of which our revered chairman speaks is at hand, my brothers, he said to the assemblage. Each of us has a detachment of church soldiers at his disposal. In view of the current crisis, I propose that we immediately turn control of those troops over to the militant orders.
Will you strip us of our only protection, Emben?
Markova protested.
The protection of the Holy City is far more important, Markova, Emben told him. Will history say of us that we were so cowardly that we refused our aid to our Holy Mother in her time of need, out of timidity and a craven concern for our own skins? Pray God that no such poltroon contaminates us by his presence in our midst. What says the hierocracy? Shall we make this insignificant sacrifice for the sake of the Church?
The rumble of assent this time was slightly pained in some quarters.
Will any patriarch call for a vote on the matter?
Dolmant asked with cool correctness. He looked around at the now silent tears.
Then let the recorder set down the fact that the suggestion of the Patriarch of Eucera was accepted by general acclamation. The scribes will then draw up suitable documents, which each member of the hierocracy will sign, transferring command of his personal detachment of church soldiers over to the militant orders for the defense of the city.
He paused.
Will someone please ask the commander of the archprelate's personal guard to present himself before the hierocracy?
A priest scurried to the door, and shortly thereafter, a brawny officer with red hair, a polished breastplate, and armed with an embossed shield and antiquated short sword, entered. His expression clearly showed that he was aware of the army at the city gates.
One question, Colonel, Dolmant said to him. My brothers have asked me to chair their deliberations. In the absence of an archprelate, do I speak in his stead?
The colonel considered it for a moment.
You do, Your Grace, he admitted, looking somewhat pleased.
That's unheard of, Markova protested,
obviously a bit chagrined that he had not taken advantage of this obscure rule during his own tenure as chairman.
So is the situation, Markova, Dolmant told him. A crisis of the faith has only been declared 5 times in the history of the Church, and in each of the 4 preceding crises, a vigorous archprelate occupied the throne that so sadly stands empty before us. When faced with unique circumstances, we must improvise. This is what we are going to do, Colonel. The patriarchs are each going to sign documents turning command of their individual detachments of soldiers over to the church knights. To save time and unnecessary arguments, as soon as those documents are signed, you and your men will escort each patriarch to the barracks of his sundry forces, where the patriarch may confirm his written command in person.
He turned then to look at the preceptors.
Lord Abriel, he said, will you and your fellow preceptors dispatch knights to take command of the soldiers just as soon as they are released, and to assemble them in a place of your choosing? Our deployment must be quick and unfaltering.
Abriel stood.
We will, Your Grace,
he declared, and gladly.
Thank you, my lord Abriel, Dolmant said. He looked back at the ranks of the hierocracy, rising tier upon tier above him.
We have done what we can, my brothers, he said to them. It seems most appropriate now that we proceed immediately to turn our soldiers over to the Knights of the Church, and then perhaps we might each devote ourselves to seeking counsel from God. Perhaps he, in his infinite wisdom, will suggest further steps we might take to defend his beloved church. Therefore, without objection, the hierocracy stands in recess until such time as this crisis has passed.
Brilliant! Xavier exclaimed. In one series of master strokes, they've wrested control of the hierocracy from Annius, stripped him of all his soldiers, and forestalled the taking of any votes while we're not here to stop them.
It's kind of a shame that they broke off so quickly, Callan said. The way things stand right now, we only need one more vote to elect our own archprelate.
Sparhawk was elated as he and his companions joined the crush at the door to the audience chamber. Although Martell was still a grave threat to the Holy City, they had succeeded in wresting control of the hierocracy from Annius and his underlings, and the weakness of the Primate of Cimera's grasp on his votes was clearly demonstrated by the defection of four of his bought-and-paid-for patriarchs. As he started to move slowly from the chamber, he felt again that now familiar sense of overpowering dread. He half turned. This time he even partially saw it. The shadow was back behind the archprelate's throne, seeming to undulate softly in the dimness. Sparhawk's hand went to the front of his surcoat to make sure that Belium was still where it belonged. The jewel was secure, and he knew that the drawstring on the pouch was tightly tied. It appeared that his reasoning had been slightly faulty. The shadow could make an appearance independently of the Belium. It was even here, inside the most consecrated building of the Aline faith. He had thought that here, of all places, he would be free of it. But it was not so. Troubled, he continued with his friends from the room that now seemed dark and chill. The attempt on Sparhawk's life came almost immediately after he saw the shadow. A cowled monk, one of the many in the crowd at the door, spun suddenly and drove a small dagger directly at the big Pandion's unvisored face. It was only Sparhawk's trained reflexes that saved him. Without thinking, he blocked the dagger stroke with his armored forearm, and then seized the monk. With a despairing cry, the monk drove his little dagger into his own side. He stiffened abruptly, and Sparhawk felt a violent shudder pass through the body of the man he was holding. Then the monk's face went blank, and he sagged limply.
Calton, Sparhawk whispered to his friend, give me a hand, keep him on his feet.
Calton stepped swiftly to the other side of the monk's body and took his arm.
Is our brother unwell?
Another monk asked them as they half carried the body out through the door.
Fainted, Calton replied in an offhand manner. Some people can't stand crowds. My friend and I will take him into some side chamber and let him get his breath.
Slick, Sparhawk muttered a quick compliment.
You see, Sparhawk, I can think on my feet.
Calton jerked his head toward the door of a nearby antechamber. Let's take him in there and have a look at him. They dragged the body into the chamber and closed the door behind them. Calton pulled the dagger from the monk's side.
Not much of a weapon, he said disdainfully.
It was enough, Sparhawk growled. One little nick with it stiffened him up like a plank.
Poison? Calton guessed.
Probably, unless the sight of his own blood overpowered him. Let's have a look. Sparhawk bent and tore open the monk's robe. The monk was a Rendor.
Isn't that interesting? Calton said. It looks as if that crossbowman who's been trying to kill you has started hiring outside help.
Maybe this is the crossbowman.
No way, Sparhawk. The crossbowman's been hiding in the general population. Anybody with half a brain would recognize a Rendor. He couldn't have just mingled with the crowd.
You're probably right. Give me the dagger. I think I'd better show it to Sophronia.
Martell really doesn't want to meet you, does he?
What makes you think Martell's behind this?
What makes you think he isn't?
What about this? Calton pointed at the body on the floor.
Leave it.
The caretakers here in the Basilica will run across it eventually and dispose of it for us. Many of the church soldiers submitted their resignations when they discovered that they were being placed under the command of the church knights. The officers did, at any rate. Resignation is not an option available to common soldiers. These resignations, however, were not accepted, but the knights were not totally insensitive to the feelings of the various colonels, captains, and lieutenants who felt strong moral compunctions about commanding their forces under such circumstances. They graciously divested such officers of their rank and enrolled them as common soldiers. They then marched the red-tunicked troops to the great square in front of the basilica for deployment on the walls and at the gates of the inner city.
"Did you have any trouble?" Euloth asked Tinian, as the two of them, each leading a sizable detachment of soldiers, met at an intersection.
"A few resignations was about all," Tinian shrugged. "I have a whole new group of officers in this batch."
"So do I," Euloth replied. "A lot of old sergeants are in charge now."
"I ran across Bavier a while back," Tinian said, as the two rode toward the main gate of the inner city. "He doesn't seem to be having the same problem for some reason."
"The reason should be fairly obvious, Tinian." Euloth grinned. "Word of what he did to that captain who tried to keep us out of the basilica has gotten around."
Euloth pulled off his ogre-horned helmet and scratched his head.
"I think it was the praying afterward that chilled everybody's blood the most. It's one thing to lop off a man's head in the heat of a discussion, but praying for his soul afterward has a very unsettling effect on most people, for some reason."
"That's probably it," Tinian agreed. He looked back at the soldiers straggling disconsolately toward the site of what was very likely to be actual fighting. Church soldiers, for the most part, did not enlist in order to fight, and they viewed the impending unpleasantness with a vast lack of enthusiasm.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen," Tinian chided them, "this won't do at all. You must try to look like soldiers, at least. Please, straighten up those ranks and try to march in step. We do have some reputation to maintain, after all."
He paused a moment.
"How about a song, gentlemen?" he suggested. "The people are always encouraged when soldiers sing as they march into battle. It's a demonstration of bravery, after all. It shows a manly contempt for death and dismemberment."
The song that rose from the ranks was feeble, and Tinian insisted that the soldiers start over, several times, until the full-throated bawling of the column satisfied his need for a display of martial enthusiasm.
"You're a cruel sort of fellow, Tinian," Euloth noted.
"I know," Tinian agreed. Sophrania's reaction to the news of the failed attack by the disguised Rendor was almost one of indifference. "You're sure you saw the shadow behind the Archprelate's throne just before the attack?" she asked Sparhawk. He nodded. "Our hypothesis still seems quite valid, then." She said it almost with satisfaction. She looked at the small, poison-smeared dagger lying on the table between them. "Hardly the sort of thing you'd want to use against an armored man," she observed.
"A scratch would have done the trick, little mother."
"How could he have scratched you when you were wrapped in steel?"
"He tried to stab me in the face, Sophrania."
"Keep your visor closed, then."
"Won't that look a little ridiculous?"
"Which do you prefer, ridiculous or dead? Did any of our friends see the attempt?"
"Calton did, or at least he knew that it happened."
She frowned. "That's too bad. I know you were hoping that we could sort of keep this between ourselves, at least until we know what's going on."
"Calton knows that someone's been trying to kill me. They all do, for that matter. They all think it's just Martell, and that he's up to his usual tricks."
"Let's sort of leave it at that, then, shall we?"
"There have been some desertions, my lord," Calton reported to Vanion as the group gathered on the steps of the basilica. "There was no way we could keep word of what we were doing from reaching some of those outlying barracks."
"It was to be expected," Vanion said. "Did anybody happen to look over the outer wall to see what Martell's doing?"
"Bayrett's been keeping an eye on things, my lord," Calton replied. "That boy's going to make an awfully good Pandion. We ought to try to keep him alive if we can. Anyway, he reports that Martell's almost completed his deployment. He could probably give the order to march on the city right now. I'm surprised that he hasn't, really. I'm sure some of Annie's toadies have reached him by now to report what happened in the basilica this morning. Every moment he delays just gives us more time to get ready for him." Greed, Calton, Sparhawk told his friend. Martell's very greedy, and he can't believe that his greed's not universal. He thinks we'll try to defend the whole of Kyrillos, and he wants to give us time to get spread so thin that he'll be able to walk over us. He'd never be able to bring himself to believe that we'd abandon the outer city and concentrate on defending the inner walls. I suspect that many of my brother patriarchs feel much the same way, Emban said. The voting might have been much tighter if those of them with palaces in the outer city had been aware of the fact that we're going to abandon their houses to Martell. Comier and Euleth came up the marble steps to join them. We're going to have to pull down some houses just outside the walls, Comier said. Those are Lamarcks to the north of the city, and Lamarcks use crossbows. We don't want any rooftops out there for them to shoot at us from. The Genidian preceptor paused. I'm not very experienced at sieges, he admitted. What kind of engines is this Martell likely to bring against us? Battering rams, Abriel told him. Catapults, assault towers. What's an assault tower? It's a sort of high structure. They roll it up until it's flush against the wall. Then the soldiers come spilling out right in the middle of us. It's a way to cut down on the sort of casualties they'll take with scaling ladders. Roll? Comier asked. The towers are on wheels. Comier grunted. We'll leave the rubble from the houses we pulled down lying in the streets then. Wheels don't run too well across piles of building blocks. Bayret came galloping into the broad square and along the quickly opened path through the ranks of the church soldiers massed in front of the basilica. He leaped from his saddle and ran up the stairs. "My lords," he said a little breathlessly, "Martell's men are beginning to assemble their siege engines." "Will someone explain that to me?" Comier asked. "The engines are transported in pieces, Comier," Abriel told him. "When you get to the place where you're going to fight, you have to put them together." "How long's that likely to take? You Arshans are the experts on castles and sieges." "Quite a few hours, Comier. The mangonels will take longer. You'll have to construct those here." "What's a mangonel?" "It's a sort of oversized catapult. It's too big to transport, even if you break it down. They use whole trees when they build them." "How big a rock can it throw?" "A half a ton or so." "The walls won't take too many of those." "That's sort of the idea, I think. You'll be using the standard catapults at first, though. The mangonels will probably take at least a week to build." "The catapults and battering rams and towers should keep us occupied until then, I suppose," Comier said sourly. "I hate sieges." Then he shrugged. "We'd better get at it." He looked disdainfully at the church soldiers. "Let's set these enthusiastic volunteers to work, tearing down houses and cluttering up the streets." At some point, not long after dark, some of Martell's scouts discovered that the outer walls of Kyrillos were undefended. A few of them, the stupider ones, reported back. For the most part, however, these scouts proved to be the vanguard of the looters. An hour or so before midnight, Bayret woke Sparhawk and Calton to report that there were troops in the outer city. Then he turned to leave again. "Where are you going?" Sparhawk asked bluntly.
"Back out there, Sir Sparhawk."
"No, you're not. You stay inside the inner walls now. I don't want you getting yourself killed."
"Somebody has to keep an eye on things, Sir Sparhawk,"
Bayret objected. "There's a cupola on top of the dome of the basilica," Sparhawk told him. "Go get Curic, and then the two of you go up there to watch."
"All right, Sir Sparhawk."
Bayret's tone was slightly sullen. "Bayret," Calton said as he pulled on his mail shirt.
"Yes, Sir Calton."
"You don't have to like it, you know. You just have to do it." Sparhawk and the others went through the ancient narrow streets of the inner city and mounted the wall. The streets of the outer city were filled with bobbing torches as the mercenaries under Martell's command ran from house to house, stealing what they could. The occasional screams of women clearly said that looting was not the only thing on the minds of the attacking force. A crowd of panicky and wailing citizens stood outside the now closed gates of the inner city, pleading to be admitted, but the gates remained steadfastly closed to them. A somewhat delicate patriarch with sagging pouches under his eyes came running up the stairs to the top of the wall.
"What are you doing?" he almost shrieked at Dolmant. "Why aren't these soldiers out there defending the city?"
"It's a military decision, Calder," Dolmant replied calmly. "We don't have enough men to defend the whole of Kyrillos. We've had to pull back inside the walls of the old city."
"Are you mad? My house is out there."
"I'm sorry, Calder," Dolmant told him, "but there's nothing I can do."
"But I voted for you."
"I appreciate that."
"My house, my things, my treasures."
Patriarch Calder of Mirisham stood wringing his hands.
"My beautiful house, all my furnishings, my gold."
"Go take refuge in the Basilica, Calder," Dolmant told him coldly. "Pray that your sacrifice may find favor in the eyes of God." The Patriarch of Mirisham turned and stumbled back down the stairs, weeping bitterly.
"I think you lost a vote there, Dolmant," Emban said.
"The voting's all over, Emban, and I'm sure I could live without that particular vote anyway."
"I'm not so sure, Dolmant," Emban disagreed. "There's still one ballot yet to come. It's fairly important, and we might just need Calder before it's over."
"They've started," Tinian said sadly.
"What have?" Calton asked him.
"The fires," Tinian replied, pointing out across the city as a sudden pillar of golden orange flame and black smoke shot up through the roof of a house. "Soldiers always seem to get careless with their torches when they're looting at night."
"Isn't there something we can do?" Xavier asked urgently.
"Not a thing, I'm afraid," Tinian said. "Except maybe pray for rain."
"It's the wrong season for it," Euloth said.
"I know," Tinian sighed. Chapter 12. The looting of the outer city continued into the night. The fires spread quickly, since no one was available to check them, and the city was soon enveloped in a thick pall of smoke. From the top of the wall, Sparhawk and his friends could see wild-eyed mercenaries running through the streets, each carrying an improvised sack over his shoulder. The crowd of citizens gathered before the gates of the inner city to plead for admittance melted away as Martell's mercenaries began to appear. There were murders, of course, some of them in plain sight, and there were other atrocities as well. One unshaven Camorrian dragged a young woman from a house by the hair and disappeared with her up an alley. Her screams quite clearly told the watchers what was happening to her. A red-tunicked young church soldier standing beside Sparhawk atop the city wall began to weep openly. Then, as the somewhat shame-faced Camorrian emerged from the alley, the soldier raised his bow, aimed and released, all in one motion. The Camorrian doubled over, clutching at the arrow buried to the feathers in his belly.
"Good man," Sparhawk said shortly to the young fellow.
"That could have been my sister, Sir Knight," the soldier said, wiping at his tears. Neither of them was really prepared for what happened next. The woman, disheveled and weeping, emerged from the alley and saw her attacker writhing in the rubble-littered street. She lurched to where he lay and kicked him solidly in the face several times. Then, seeing that he was unable to defend himself, she snatched his dagger from his belt. It were best, perhaps, not to describe what she did to him next. His screams, however, echoed in the streets for quite some time. When at last he fell silent, she discarded the bloody knife, opened the sack he had been carrying, and looked inside. Then she wiped her eyes on her sleeve, tied the sack shut, and dragged it back to her house. The soldier who had shot the Camorrian started to retch violently. "Nobody's very civilized in those circumstances, neighbor," Sparhawk told him, laying a comforting hand on his shoulder. "And the lady did have a certain justification for what she just did."
"That must have hurt," the soldier said in a shaking voice.
"I think that's what she had in mind, neighbor. Go get a drink of water and wash your face. Try not to think about it."
"Thank you, Sir Knight," the young fellow said, swallowing hard.
"Perhaps not all church soldiers are so bad," Sparhawk muttered to himself, revising a long-held opinion. As the sun went down, they gathered in Sir Nashan's red-draped study in the Pandion chapter house, what Sir Tinian and Sir Euloth had come to call, not entirely in jest, the High Command. the preceptors, the three patriarchs, and Sparhawk and his friends. Curic, Bayret, and Talon, however, were not present. Sanashin hovered diffidently near the door. Sanashin was an able administrator, but he was just a bit uncomfortable in the presence of so much authority.
"If there's nothing further you need, my lords," he said, "I'll leave you to your deliberations now."
"Stay, Sanashin," Vanion told him. The preceptor smiled. "We certainly don't want to dispossess you, and your knowledge of the city may prove very useful."
"Thank you, Lord Vanion," the stout knight said, slipping into a chair.
"I think we've stolen a march on your friend Martell, Vanion," Preceptor Aubriel said.
"Have you looked over the wall lately, Aubriel?" Vanion asked dryly.
"As a matter of fact, I have," Aubriel said, "and that's exactly what I'm talking about. As Sir Sparhawk told us yesterday, this Martell couldn't believe that we'd abandon the outer city without a fight, so he didn't take it into account when he made his plans. He made no attempt to keep his scouts out of the city, and those scouts were just the forerunners of the main body of looters. As soon as his scouts found that the city was unprotected, they rushed in to loot the houses, and most of the rest of the army followed. Martell's completely lost control of his forces now, and he won't regain it until the outer city is picked clean. Not only that, as soon as his soldiers have as much as they can carry, they'll begin to desert."
"I cannot encourage theft," Patriarch Ortzel said rigidly. "But under the circumstances..."
A faint, almost sly smile touched his thin lips.
"Wealth needs to be redistributed from time to time, Ortzel," Emban pontificated. "People with too much money have too much time to think up assorted sins to commit. Perhaps this is God's way of restoring the filthy rich to a condition of wholesome poverty. I wonder if you'd feel the same way if your own house were being looted."
"That might influence my opinion, all right," Emban conceded.
"God's ways are mysterious," Davier said devoutly. "We had no choice but to abandon the outer city, and that may be the one thing that will save us."
"I don't think we can count on enough desertions from Martell's ranks to grow complacent, gentlemen," Vanion said. "The rampage of his troops will gain us some time, I'll grant you." He looked around at the other preceptors.
"A week, perhaps?" he asked.
"At the very most," Comier said. "There are a lot of men out there, and they're very busy. It's not going to take them all that long to strip the city."
"And that's when the killing's going to start," Colton said. "As you said, Lord Comier, there are a lot of men out there, and I'm fairly sure that not all of them got into the city. The ones who are still outside are just as greedy as the ones who got here first. It's going to be chaotic for a while, I think, and it's going to take Martell quite a bit longer to regain control."
"He's probably right," Comier grunted. "Either way, we've got some time. There are four gates into the inner city here, and most of them aren't much better than the ones in the outer wall. One gate's easier to defend than four, so why don't we fix it that way?"
"Are you going to make the gates disappear by magic, Comier?" Emban asked.
"I know the church knights are trained to do many unusual things, but this is the holy city, after all. Would God really approve of that sort of thing on his own doorstep?"
"I never even thought of magic," Comier admitted. "Actually, I wasn't going to use anything like that. It's very hard to batter down a gate if there are two or three collapsed houses piled up behind it, isn't it?"
"Almost impossible," Aubriel agreed. Emban grinned broadly.
"Isn't Markova's house fairly close to the east gate of the inner city?" he asked.
"Now that you mention it, Your Grace, I do believe it is," Sir Sanashin replied.
"A fairly substantial house," Comier said.
"It certainly should be," Emban said, "considering what he paid for it."
"What the Elanian taxpayers paid for it, Your Grace," Sparhawk corrected.
"Ah, yes. I'd almost forgotten that. Would the Elanian taxpayers be willing to contribute that very expensive house to the defense of the church?"
"They'd be delighted, Your Grace."
"We'll certainly look the house of the Patriarch of Coombe over very carefully when we're selecting the ones to tear down," Comier promised.
"The only question now is the whereabouts of King Worgen," Dolmant said. "Martell's blunder has bought us some time, but it won't keep him out of the inner city forever. Could your messengers have gone astray, Ortzel?"
"They're good, solid men," Ortzel said.
and an army the size of Worgen's shouldn't be hard to find. Besides, the messengers you and Emban sent earlier should have reached him quite some time ago, shouldn't they? Not to mention the ones the Earl of Lenda sent from Simera, Sparhawk added. The absence of the King of Thalesia is a mystery, Emban said, and it's becoming increasingly inconvenient. The door opened and Bayret entered. Excuse me, my lords, he apologized, but you wanted to be informed if anything unusual was happening out in the city. What have you seen, Bayret? Vanion asked him. I was up in that little house on top of the dome of the basilica, my lord. Cupola, Vanion corrected. I can never remember that word, Bayret confessed. Anyway, you can see the whole city from up there. The ordinary people are fleeing from Kyrillos. They're streaming out through all of the gates in the outer wall. Martell doesn't want them underfoot, Calton said. And he wants the women out of town, Sparhawk added bleakly. I didn't quite understand that, Sparhawk, Xavier said. I'll explain it to you later, Sparhawk told him, glancing at Sophronia. There was a knock on the door, and a Pandion knight entered. He was holding Talon by the arm, and the boy from the streets of Simera had a disgusted expression on his face and a fair-sized sack in one hand.
You wanted to see this young fellow, Sir Sparhawk? The Pandion asked.
Yes, Sparhawk replied. Thank you, Sir Knight. He looked rather sternly at Talon. Where have you been? He asked directly. Talon's expression grew evasive.
Ah, here and there, my lord, he replied.
You know that's not going to work, Talon, Sparhawk said wearily. I'll get the answer out of you eventually anyway, so why bother trying to hide it?
To keep in practice, I suppose, Talon shrugged. You'll twist my arm until I tell you, won't you, Sparhawk?
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
All right, Talon sighed. There are thieves in the streets of the inner city, and there are a lot of interesting things going on out beyond the walls. I managed to find a way to slip out there. I've been selling that information.
How's business? Patriarch Emban asked him. Emban's eyes were bright.
Not too bad, actually, Talon said professionally. Most of the thieves here inside the walls don't have too much to bargain with. You don't make much profit sitting on the things you've stolen, but I'm easy to do business with. I just charge them a percentage of what they're able to steal from the soldiers outside the walls.
Open the sack, Talon, Sparhawk ordered him.
I'm really shocked at you, Sparhawk, Talon said. These are holy men in this room. Is it really proper to expose them to... Well, you know.
Open the sack, Talon. The boy sighed, laid the sack on Sir Nashan's desk, and opened it. There were a number of largely decorative items inside, metal goblets, small statues, thick chains, assorted eating utensils, and a rather intricately engraved tray about the size of a dinner plate. All of the items appeared to be made of solid gold.
You got all this just for selling information? Tinian asked incredulously.
Information's the most valuable thing in the world, Sir Tinian, Talon replied loftily, and I'm not doing anything immoral or illegal. My conscience is perfectly clear. Not only that, I'm making my contribution to the defense of the city.
I don't quite follow that reasoning, Sir Nashan said.
The soldiers out there aren't willingly giving up what they've stolen, Sir Knight, Talon smirked. The thieves know they'll feel that way, so they don't bother to make requests. Martell's lost a fair number of his troops since the sun went down.
Most reprehensible young man, Ortzel said reprovingly.
My hands are completely clean, Your Grace, Talon replied innocently. I haven't personally stabbed a single soldier in the back. What the villains from the street do out there isn't my responsibility, is it?
The boy's eyes shone with innocence.
Give it up, Ortzel, Emban chuckled. None of us are worldly enough to argue with this young fellow.
He paused.
Dolmant, he said, tithing is a well-established practice, isn't it?
Of course, the Patriarch of Deimos said.
I was sure it was. Given the unusual circumstances here, I'd say that the young fellow should contribute a quarter of his profits to the church, wouldn't you?
It sounds about right to me, Dolmant agreed.
A quarter?
Talon exclaimed.
That's highway robbery.
Actually, we aren't on a highway, my son, Emban smiled. Would you like to settle up after each of your excursions, or should we wait until you've gathered all your profits and we can take care of it all at once?
After you've settled up with the patriarch Emban, Talon, Danion said, I have a burning curiosity about this secret way you've found to get in and out of the city.
It's not really much of a secret, Lord Vanion, Talon said deprecatingly. About all it really consists of are the names of a squad of enterprising church soldiers who have the night watch in one of the towers on the wall. They've got a nice long rope with knots tied in it to make climbing up and down easy. They're willing to rent out the rope, and I'm willing to rent out their names and the location of the tower they're guarding. Everybody's making a nice profit.
Including the church, Patriarch Emban reminded him.
I was sort of hoping you'd forgotten about that, Your Grace.
Hope is a cardinal virtue, my son, Emban said piously, even when it's misplaced.
Curate came in carrying a Limerick crossbow.
I think we may be in luck, my lords, he said. I happened to look into the armory of the archprelate's personal guard in the basilica. They've got racks and racks of these down there, and barrels of bolts.
An eminently suitable weapon, Ortzel approved. Ortzel was a Limerick, after all.
They're slower than a longbow, Your Grace, Jurek pointed out, but they do have an extraordinary range. I think they'll be very effective in breaking up charges against the inner city before they can pick up much momentum.
Do you know how to use this weapon, Curic? Vanion asked him.
Yes, Lord Vanion. Start training some church soldiers, then.
Yes, my lord.
A number of things are turning our way, my friends, Vanion said. We have a defensible position, a parity of weapons, and a certain delay working for us.
I'd still be happier if Worgen were here, Comier said.
So would I, Vanion agreed. But we'll just have to make do with what we've got until he gets here, I'm afraid.
There's something else we need to concern ourselves with, gentlemen, Emban said gravely. Assuming that all goes well, the hierocracy is going to go back into session just as soon as Martell's been driven off. Abandoning the outer city is going to alienate a sizable number of patriarchs. If you let a man's house be looted and burned, he's not going to be very fond of you or want to vote for you.
We've got to find some way to prove the connection between Aeneas and Martell.
If we don't, we're doing all this just for the exercise. I can talk as fast as the next man, but I can't perform miracles. I need something to work with.
It was about midnight when Sparhawk climbed the stairs to the wall of the old city not far from the south gate, the most defensible of the four, and the one it had been decided to leave unblocked. Kyrelos was burning in earnest now. A looter entering a house to find it already empty feels a certain angry frustration, and he usually vents his feelings by setting fire to the place. Such behavior is totally predictable, and in a certain sense quite natural. The looters, their faces more desperate now as the number of unpillaged houses diminished, ran from building to building, waving torches and weapons. Curic, always practical, had stationed the church soldiers he was training with crossbows on the walls, and the looters provided those men with moving targets upon which to practice. There were not too many hits, but the soldiers appeared to be improving. Then, from a narrow street at the edge of the zone of collapsed houses just beyond practical crossbow range, a sizable number of well-armed men on horseback emerged. The man in the lead bestrode a glossy black horse, and he wore embossed Daeran armor. He removed his helmet. It was Martell, and close behind him were the brutish Addis and the weasel-like Krager. Curic joined Sparhawk and his blonde friend.
I can have the soldiers shoot at them if you'd like, the squire said to Sparhawk.
Somebody might get lucky.
Sparhawk scratched his chin.
No, I don't think so, Curic, he said.
You're passing up an awfully good opportunity, Sparhawk, Carlton said. If Martell catches a stray crossbow bolt in the eye, that whole army out there will fall apart.
Not just yet, Sparhawk said. Let's see if I can irritate him just a bit first. Martell sometimes blurts things out when he's irritated. Let's see if I can jolt something out of him.
That's a fair distance for shouting, Colton said.
I don't have to shout. Sparhawk smiled.
I wish you wouldn't do that, Calton complained. It always makes me feel so inadequate. You should have paid attention to your lessons when you were a novice. Sparhawk focused his attention on the white-haired man and wove the intricate Styrix spell. It sort of went to pieces on you, didn't it, Martell? He asked in a conversational tone.
Is that you, Sparhawk?
Martell's voice was just as conversational as he, too, utilized the spell they had both learned as novices.
So awfully good to hear your voice again, old boy. I didn't quite follow your comment, though. Things seem to be going fairly well from where I sit. Why don't you see how many of your soldiers you can interest in an assault on these walls about now? Take as long as you want, old boy. I'm not going any place. It was really very clever to desert the city, Sparhawk. I wasn't expecting that. We sort of liked it. It must be causing you a great deal of anguish every time you think about all the loot that's getting away from you, though.
Who said it's getting away? I made a few speeches to my men. Most of my army is still under control, out there in the meadows on the other sides of those rivers. I pointed out to them that it's much easier to let the enterprising types do all the work of looting. Then, when they come out, we take the loot away from them and put it all into a common pile. Everybody will share equally.
Even you?
Oh, good God, no, Sparhawk. Martell laughed. I'm the general. I take my share first.
The lion's share?
I am the lion, after all.
We'll all grow very, very wealthy once we break into the treasure vaults below the basilica.
That's going a little far even for you, Martell.
Business is business, Sparhawk. You and Vanion stripped me of my honor, so now all I can do is solace myself with money. And satisfaction, of course. I think I'll have your head mounted when this is all over, my friend.
It's right here, Martell. All you have to do is come and claim it.
It's going to take your soldiers a long time to loot the city, and you don't really have much time to waste.
It won't take them all that long, Sparhawk. They're moving along at a very good clip, you know. A man who thinks he's working for himself is always more industrious. That's only the first wave of looters. They're the ones who are concentrating on gold. The next wave will go looking for silver. Then the third wave will start tearing houses apart, looking for the hiding places where people keep valuables.
I'd guess that it's going to be a month or so before they've stolen everything in Kyrelos, down to the last brass candlestick.
You don't really have a month, old boy. Not with Worgen wandering around out there with half the manpower in Eosia behind him.
Ah, yes, Worgen, the drunken king of Thalesia. I'd almost forgotten him. What do you suppose happened to him? It's so unlike him to be this tardy.
Sparhawk broke the spell.
Have your soldiers drop some arrows on him, Curic, he said bleakly.
What's the trouble, Sparhawk? Calton asked.
Martell's found some way to keep Worgen away from Kyrelos. We'd better go advise the Perceptors. I'm afraid we're all alone here.
Chapter 13
He didn't say it exactly, Vanion, Sparhawk reported. You know how he is. But there was that sort of implied smirk in his voice that he knows is so irritating. We both know Martell well enough to know what he meant.
What exactly did he say again, Sir Sparhawk? Dolmant asked.
We were talking about Worgen, Your Grace, and he said, What do you suppose has happened to him? It's so unlike him to be this tardy.
Sparhawk did his best to imitate Martell's intonation.
It does have a knowing sort of ring to it, doesn't it? Dolmant agreed. I don't know Martell as well as the two of you do, but that has the sound of a man who's terribly pleased with himself.
Sparhawk's right, Sophronia told them. Martell's worked out some way to keep Worgen away. The question is, how?
How isn't important, little mother, Vanion said.
The four of them were sitting together in a small room adjacent to Sir Noshan's study. What's important now is keeping this information away from the soldiers. The church knights are trained to accept desperate circumstances. The soldiers aren't. About all they're clinging to at the moment is the expectation of seeing Worgen's armies coming across the meadows lying to the west of the River Aruk. The inner city's not really surrounded yet, and the looters aren't paying any attention to other people. We could have desertions by the score if word of this gets out. Advise the church knights quietly and in confidence. I'll tell the other preceptors.
And I'll tell Emben and Ortsal, Dolmant promised. The weeks seemed to drag, although there were many, many things that had to be done. Houses were pulled down and their rubble used to block the three gates that Comyr had decided were only marginally defensible. Curic continued to train selected church soldiers in the use of their crossbows. Beirut gathered a group of young monks, and they traded off keeping watch from the cupola atop the basilica dome. Emben scurried about inside the basilica itself, trying to maintain his hold on votes, although that grew more and more difficult. None of the defenders had the temerity to refuse the patriarchs of the church the right to ascend the walls to look out at the city, and the view from those walls was not very encouraging. A fair number of patriarchs, several of them in the very forefront of the fight to keep the primate of Simera off the throne, lamented bitterly as the fires approached the quarters of the city in which their houses lay. And not a few told Emben to his face that he could forget about any future support. Emben grew drawn-looking, and he began to complain of pains in his stomach as he watched his support melting before his eyes. Aeneas did nothing. He simply waited. And Kyrelos continued to burn. Sparhawk stood atop the wall early one evening, looking out over the burning city. His mood was somber. He heard a slight clinking behind him and turned quickly. It was Sabavia. "Not too promising, is it?" the young Arshan said, also looking out at Kyrelos. "Not really," Sparhawk agreed. He looked directly at his young friend. "How long do you think these walls will stand up to a mangonel, Bavier?" "Not very long, I'm afraid. The walls were built in antiquity. They weren't meant to stand up to modern siege engines. Perhaps Martell won't bother to construct them. They take a long time to build, and the workers have to know exactly what they're doing. A poorly constructed mangonel will kill more of its crew than it will the enemy. There's a good deal of stress involved when you load one." "We can hope, I suppose. I think these walls will stand up to ordinary catapults, but if he starts lobbing half-ton boulders at us..." Sparhawk shrugged.
"Sparhawk!"
It was Talon. The boy came quickly up the stairs from below.
"Sophrania wants to see you at the chapter house. She says it's urgent."
"Go ahead, Sparhawk," Xavier said. "I'll keep watch here." Sparhawk nodded and went down the stairs to the narrow street below. Sophrania met him in the lower hall. Her face was even more pale than usual. "What is it?" Sparhawk asked her.
"It's Perrain, dear one," she replied in a hushed voice. "He's dying."
"Dying? There haven't been any attacks yet. What happened to him?"
"He's killed himself, Sparhawk."
"Perrain?"
"He's taken poison of some kind, and he refuses to tell me what it is."
"Is there any way..." She shook her head.
"He wants to talk with you, Sparhawk. You'd better hurry. I don't think there's much time."
Sir Perrain lay on the narrow cot in a cell-like room. His face was deathly pale, and he was sweating profusely.
"You certainly took your time, Sparhawk," he said in a weak-sounding voice.
"What's this all about, Perrain?"
"It's something appropriate. Let's not waste any time with this. There are some things you need to know before I leave."
"We can talk about that after Sophrania gives you the antidote."
"There isn't going to be any antidote. Just be still and listen to me."
Perrain sighed deeply.
"I've betrayed you, Sparhawk."
"You aren't capable of that, Perrain."
"Anyone's capable of it, my friend. All he needs is some kind of reason. I had one, believe me. Hear me out. I don't have much time left."
He closed his eyes for a moment.
"You've noticed that someone's been trying to kill you lately, haven't you?"
"Yes, but what's..."
"It was me, Sparhawk. Or people I'd hired."
"You?"
"Thank God I failed."
Why, Perrine? Have I insulted you somehow?
Don't be foolish, Sparhawk. I was acting on orders from Martell.
Why would you take orders from Martell?
Because he was holding something over my head. He was threatening someone who was more precious to me than my life itself.
Sparhawk was stunned. He started to speak, but Perrine held up one hand.
Don't talk, Sparhawk, he said. Listen. There isn't much time. Martell came to me in Dabur just after Arasham died. I went for my sword, of course, but he just laughed at me. He told me to put up the sword if I cared anything at all about Idra.
Idra?
She's from northern Pelosia. Her father's barony adjoins the one belonging to my father. Idra and I have loved each other since we were children. I'd die for her without giving it a second thought. Martell knew that somehow, and he reasoned that if I were willing to die for her, I'd also be willing to kill. He told me that he'd given her soul to Azash. I didn't believe him. I didn't think he could really do that.
Sparhawk remembered Count Gossek's sister, Belina. It can be done, Perrine, he said bleakly.
That's what I found out. Martell and I traveled to Pelosia. He showed Idra to me when she was performing some obscene rite before an image of Azash.
Tears stood openly in Perrine's eyes.
It was horrible, Sparhawk, horrible!
He choked back a sob.
Martell told me that if I didn't do exactly as he told me, her corruption would increase until her soul was totally lost. I wasn't sure if he could really do what he said he would, but I couldn't take that chance.
He could do it all right. Sparhawk assured him. I've seen it.
I was going to kill her,
Perrine went on, his voice growing weaker.
But I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Martell watched me struggle with myself, and he just laughed at me. If you ever get the opportunity, I hope you kill him.
You have my word on that, Perrine. Perrine sighed again, and his face grew even more pale.
An excellent poison, this one,
he noted.
Anyway, Martell had his fist around my heart. He told me to go to Arsham and to join Vanion and the other Pandions there. At the first opportunity, I was to make my way back to the chapter house in Simera. Somehow he knew that you were going to Thalasia, and that you'd most likely be returning through Emsat. He gave me money, and instructed me to start hiring murderers. I had to do everything he told me to do. Most of the time it was my assassins who made the attempts on you. But once, when we were coming through Deimos on our way here, I actually shot a crossbow at you myself. I could try to pretend that I missed on purpose, but that would be a lie. I was really trying to kill you, Sparhawk.
And the poison at Dolman's house?
Yes. I was getting desperate. You have uncommonly good luck, my friend. I tried everything I could think of, and I just couldn't kill you.
And the Rendor who tried to stick a poisoned knife in me in the Basilica? Perrine looked a bit startled.
I had nothing to do with that, Sparhawk, I swear. We've both been in Rendor, and we both know how undependable they are. Someone else must have sent him. Maybe even Martell himself.
What made you change your mind, Perrine? Sparhawk asked sadly.
Martell's lost his hold on me. Idra's dead.
I'm sorry.
I'm not. Somehow she realized what was happening. She went to the chapel in her father's house and prayed all night. Then, just as the sun was coming up, she drove a dagger into her heart. She'd sent one of her footmen here with a letter explaining everything that had happened. He arrived just before Martell's army encircled the city. She's free now, and her soul is safe.
Why did you take poison, then?
I'm going to follow her, Sparhawk. Martell's stolen my honor, but he can never steal my love.
Perrine stiffened on his narrow cot, and he twisted in agony for a moment.
Yes, he gasped, an excellent poison. I'd recommend it by name, but I don't altogether trust our little mother here.
Given half a chance, I think she could resurrect a stone.
He smiled at their teacher.
Can you find it in your heart to forgive me, Sparhawk?
There's nothing to forgive, Perrain, Sparhawk said in a thick voice, taking his friend's hand. Perrain sighed.
I'm sure they'll strike my name from the Pantheon rolls, and I'll be remembered with contempt.
Not if I can help it, they won't, Sparhawk told him. I'll protect your honor, my friend. He gripped Perrain's hand tightly in an unspoken pledge. Sophronia reached across the bed and took the dying man's other hand.
It's almost over, Perrain said in a faint whisper. I wish...
And then he fell silent. Sophronia's wail of grief was almost like that of a hurt child. She pulled Perrain's limp body to her. There's no time for that, Sparhawk told her sharply. Will you be all right here for a while? I have to go get Curic. She stared at him in astonishment. We have to dress Perrain in his armor, he explained. Then Curic and I can take him to one of those streets just inside the wall. We'll shoot a crossbow bolt into his chest and lay him in the street. They'll find him later, and everyone will believe that one of Martell's mercenaries shot him off the wall.
But, Sparhawk, why?
Perrain was my friend, and I promised to protect his honor.
But he tried to kill you, dear one.
No, little mother. Martell tried to kill me. He forced Perrain to help him. The guilt's all Martell's, and one of these days, before very long, I'm going to make him answer for it. He paused. You might start thinking about that hypothesis of ours, he added. This seems to poke quite a large hole in it. Then he remembered the Rendor with the poisoned knife. Either that or there's more than just one assassin out there to worry about, he added. The first probing attacks came after 5 days of looting. They were tentative, designed primarily to identify strong points and weak ones. The defenders had certain advantages here. Martell had received his training from Banion, and Banion could therefore predict almost exactly what the white-haired former Pandion would do, and moreover, he could marshal his forces so as to dissemble and deceive. The probing attacks grew stronger. They came sometimes at dawn, sometimes late in the day, and sometimes in the middle of the night when darkness shrouded the smoky city. The church knights were always on the alert. They never removed their armor, and they slept in snatches whenever and wherever they could. It was when the outer city lay almost entirely in ruins that Martell moved his siege engines into place to begin the steady pounding of the inner city. Large rocks rained from the sky, crushing soldiers and citizens alike. Large baskets were mounted on some of Martell's catapults, and bushels of crossbow bolts were launched high into the air to drop indiscriminately into the ancient city. Then came the fire. Balls of burning pitch and naphtha came sailing over the walls to ignite the roofs and to fill the streets with great splashes of searing fire. There were as yet no half-ton boulders, however. The defenders endured. There was nothing else they could do. Lord Arbriel began to construct engines of his own to respond, but aside from the rubble of destroyed houses, there was very little at hand to throw at Martell in reply. They endured. And each stone, each fireball, each shower of arrows dropping from the sky in a deadly rain only increased their hatred of the besiegers. The first serious assault came not long after midnight, 8 days after the looting had begun. A disorganized horde of Renderish fanatics came shrieking out of the dark, smoky streets to the southwest, bent on attacking a somewhat shaky bartizan on the corner of the old wall in that quarter. The defenders rushed to that point. Sheets of arrows and crossbow bolts swept through the black-robed ranks of the Rendors, felling them in windrows like new-mown wheat. The shrieks took on that note of agony that has risen from every battlefield since the beginning of time. On and on, however, came the Rendors, men so wildly gripped by religious frenzy that they paid no heed to their dreadful casualties, some of them even ignoring mortal wounds as they dragged themselves toward the walls. The pitch! Sparhawk shouted to the soldiers who were feverishly shooting arrows and bolts down into the seething mass of the attackers below. Cauldrons of boiling pitch
were dragged to the edge of the walls even as the scaling ladders came angling up from below to clatter against the weather-worn battlements. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.